The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning. Great to be with you again. About a year or so ago, I was asked to speak on anxiety and peace, and my youngest daughter, who lived with me at that stage, Eloise, 22 years of age, asked what I was preparing this talk on, and I said, anxiety, and she laughed and said, what would you know about anxiety? Because for whatever reason, I often ponder that, why some people are more anxious than others, and particularly having become a Christian some years ago, why some Christians remain anxious and why some of us are more anxious than others. I don't know whether or not it may be partly a genetic thing. It may be partly for me that I grew up in a family where basically the key people in my life were fairly trustworthy. So you just learn that, you know, things just work. I don't actually know why it is. But one of the things that struck me when I came to the city a couple of years ago to work with CBF was the amount of anxiety there was in the city. Particularly people who were working in some of the large banks, working in Telstra, some of these companies where at least the CEO of one of the companies, I just think is a complete idiot in terms of the way he related to his employees when he said at one stage and was quoted in the Herald, no one's position is safe. I thought, boy, you are a genius at how to motivate people. I mean, terrific. And then he said, not even my position. I thought, you liar. Of course your position's safe. If you behave really badly and perform really badly, you just get millions of dollars and sent off to the next company. So, I mean, it was just a nonsense for him to pretend that he was living under the same stress. And I knew a couple of men in this particular company who said to me that they were not sleeping. Now, in the end, they didn't lose their jobs. But I was surprised. I spoke to a very impressive man I've met in the city. He's not here today, although there are impressive men here. I don't want you to think that only unimpressive men can come. But when we talked about why he was looking at Christianity, he just said to me, he said, Ian, I would just like to experience some peace. Now, this is a man who I would have thought had every reason to be peaceful. I mean, he had some relational stresses, but he seemed to me to be enormously wealthy. He was handsome. He just gained access after a long process into a club that when he told me what you had to do to become a member, I thought I'd hate to be a member of a club like that. It seemed so appallingly enclosed and only letting their own type in, but no, he'd got in, and yet what he felt was this terrible lack of peace. Now, a few of us, having seen the title that you've got there, a few of us can help but think of the British Prime Minister who came back one day before the Nazis attacked one of their neighbours, waving a piece of paper, and I think in good faith, believing that we had peace in our times. Although he didn't use that at the airport, he used that exact phrase later on outside the 10 Downing Street, quoting either deliberately or indeliberately a great line out of the Book of Common Prayer. Today I'm not going to speak about the question of external peace, but the question of internal peace. The peace that passes all understanding, as the Bible says, which I think is in contrast to anxiety. Shalom, if you like, at least half of the shalom, that Jewish idea of peace as I understand it, is the absence of war on the outside, but it's also the presence of a sense of well-being and peace and the ability to be at ease. Now, you probably know that according to the Bureau of Statistics, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, the most common mental illness that Australians struggle with is anxiety. That's quite clear. Related to it, and coming second, is depression. And I find it puzzling that Australians are so anxious, and increasingly so. The studies are quite clear that both in Australia and in America, it's not just that there's better reporting of anxiety, but there's a number of studies that Martin Seligman points to, particularly in the States, that indicate that the generations are getting more depressed and more anxious. Although, I would have thought living in my era, I have less reason to be anxious than my parents and less reason to be anxious than my grandparents. When my mother and father were about my age, they genuinely had the real concern of nuclear holocaust in a way that we don't. My parents, my grandparents especially, they went through the Great Depression, they went through the Great War, lost any number of friends. We live in a period, particularly in Australia, where things are pretty good. The chances of us starving to death, dying of the cold, any of the basic sort of killers that people live with, pretty much gone for us. And yet we are increasingly anxious people. Now anxiety is, just in terms of definition, I sometimes think of it as industrial strength worry. We'll worry about, I mean, it would be lying to say to you I wasn't anxious when I was in the car coming this morning. Things had just gone wrong. The traffic wasn't as it should have been. I'd cut the run a bit late anyhow because I was packing my bag to go away because I'm catching a plane away this afternoon just for a night. And I was worried. Will I get there? Is Peter going to beat me up? Will I have my pay docked? Will anybody be there? Will they have gone home? I thought, well, thanks, Ian, for your vote of respect. But I was worried, and anxiety is industrial strength worry. Anxiety is normally used when it begins to affect your capacity to enjoy life. It's sometimes said it's on the... They often speak about things as being on a spectrum now. The fear or the worry spectrum, where you have at one end terror, panic, and at the other end mild concern, and anxiety is down this end. The difference between fear and worry is quite helpful to get clear, because if I pulled a gun on you and it was real and I wanted to show that I meant business, so I shot Adrian in the foot just so I wasn't all bark and trousers, whatever, wherever that lovely expression comes from, that I actually meant business, and then I made some threats. Now, if you were texting, although most of you look too cultured to be texting while adventures are going on, if you were busy texting, what you wouldn't be texting to your friend would be, I'm feeling a tad anxious. Because if I have a gun on the point, what you have there is fear or terror. And the difference between fear and anxiety is helpful to know. Fear tends to deal with a present, specific threat. So it can be dealt with. It can be focused on. What you would have if I had a specific, the gun, would be fear. Whereas anxiety, in the way that it's generally used, is it has a sense of the future rather than the present. And it's unspecific often. You've got to often stop and think, why am I feeling anxious? Whereas if you were feeling fearful, you'd pretty much not have to ask that question. And so one of the problems with anxiety is that it's not normally based in one thing. And it's just a general what-if sense. So it's almost always to do with the future. You can be living in beautiful physical comfort with the best of friends, committed friendships, covenanted love, etc., and you know, you've got good superannuation worked out and you've just had a health check, but you can still be feeling anxious. And sometimes it does take a while to work out what that is and where it's come from. It's a natural and quite a healthy sense that we're vulnerable, that life is dangerous. And as you know, life is dangerous. As they say lightheartedly, no one gets out of here alive. And there's all sorts of threats, not just death, but threats just to your well-being, whether it be emotional. In fact, there was a study done, I think it was from Macquarie Uni recently, where the professors were a little disappointed that Australians were not so anxious about the environmental crisis coming our way, etc., but about work. And it varied, particularly people from between 25 and 35 are particularly anxious about work and relationships, which I would have thought was obvious in the end. That's the things that humans really worry about. It's about, will I be able to get enough to live? Will I be loved? Are the two sort of basic questions that people live with. Now, every culture struggles with fear. And one of the weird things that people say sometimes, I haven't heard anyone here say it, where people will hear something in the Bible about life, some of the statements that Jesus makes about do not worry, and they'll say silly things, unthought out things like, well, it's easy for them to say back then, but in the real hustle and bustle of the modern, that is so much nonsense, isn't it? In terms of threats to our existence, in terms of the vulnerability of life and the way it can turn at the moment, much, much worse in the time of Jesus and before. You could just be farming away and the local hordes on their camels or their horses, generally speaking camels, the Arameans are famous for this, could come riding over the horizon. There's no border control at all. No inappropriate joke, I just withheld myself. There's no border control at all. And suddenly they come over, you're all dead, your children are taken away in slaves. And that's why there were stories that Jesus tells about treasure hidden in a field. Because when that happened, people just dug a hole and hid their treasures. And if they all got killed and all got... So you did sometimes just bump into a treasure in the field that some poor, vulnerable person had hidden, hoping to get back to it and never did. Now, in that sort of situation, you run into a psalm like Psalm 23, and it sort of exudes a beautiful sense of peace and calm in a very anxious age. And it is one of the psalms that I think, whether it be Jews or Christians, this is one of the favourite psalms, because it not only exudes a sense of calm, but within it the keys whereby we live masterfully over anxiety. And when we find ourselves fearful, to go to this psalm and find keys in it to help us find our way to peace. So the famous, "The Lord is my shepherd." And it's quite logical in the way it works. Basically, the first statement there, "The Lord is my shepherd," everything hangs on that. If you can say those words, understand them and mean them, the rest of the psalm is yours. If that first five words is just beautiful poetry, but you don't understand the relationship between the sheep and the shepherd, you don't understand what it's like to have a good shepherd, you don't understand how that fleshes out into human life, the rest of the psalm is just background music. It might be nice, but it will not be very meaningful. The Lord is my shepherd. There's a therefore implicit but not stated. Therefore, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. That is for a sheep. That's like heaven, right? Sheep almost never lie down. They only lie down when all their fears and needs are met. But he lies down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. Pathetic a sheep that if you put them beside a good, wholesome, robust river, they're frightened of the noise. Sheep will only relax really when there's quiet waters. And also they can fall into them and drown in them. They're remarkably. I don't like the fact that the sheep. I'd rather be parallel to a duck, frankly, than a sheep. Both are quite tasty to eat, if prepared properly. But I mean, ducks can fly, they can swim on the water, they can swim under the water, they've got a real fancy waddle. But sheep are pathetic, they are timid. I'm sure there's an explanation how on earth they evolved till men looked after them. It's a bit of a mystery to me, because they're so tasty. The general thing that the shepherd does, he restores my soul. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the path of death, I fear no evil. You are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You've anointed my head with oil. Isn't it interesting that David is not speaking about him as a person who doesn't have fears and doesn't have enemies? He has enemies. They're right there in the psalm. But they've been dealt with in a sense, but they haven't been killed. You've anointed my head with oil, my cup overflows. Summary of life and death, verse 6. Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life. I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, what sort of pathetic creature relates to God as his shepherd? One of the discussions I've had with one of my old friends from school, and I think he's actually learnt the lesson, good on him. He used to constantly, as is the wont in the last couple of years, speak about God as your invisible friend. I wrote a letter to the Herald recently, which didn't get printed, as it shouldn't have. There were better letters on the same issue. But where I was responding to a person who spoke about God as some sort of, you know, the something or other fairy. I've said to my friend, look, by all means, if you want to mock the God I believe in, do. But I said, I've never, ever spoken to him, and I don't relate to him fundamentally, which is part of that whole pejorative, let's mock rather than just deal with. The idea that, you know, little losers sometimes invent invisible friends. By the way, if you had an invisible friend, I'm sure you weren't a loser. But the idea that people who don't have friends and are a bit timid, they invent invisible friends. Christians are just people who have never grown up, they invent an invisible friend. Where, of course, the God that you meet in the Bible is not your invisible friend. The notion of God as friend is entirely secondary. Really meeting God, as you know, is quite a traumatic experience when you meet the real God. Quite a civil war goes on in that. Who is it that speaks like this? Well, as you know, it's King David. Now, David is not a damp-eyed Nancy boy. David is an alpha male. He's a danger to people who've got handsome wives. He's a great military leader. He's physically strong. He's handsome. I've seen a statue of him in Florence, which must be accurate. He's very big and very good looking and quite impressive. He's a warrior. He grew up in a shepherding family. As a young man, he was out looking after the family sheep and had to fight with a lion and won. He fights with Goliath. You know, this is no pansy. This is not someone who lives in the city, and if there's a loud noise, they call the police. This is a man's man. In fact, he's a terrifying. He was a woman's man too. They loved him. And it's David who speaks about himself as a sheep and God as a shepherd. Because I think sometimes you have to be sufficiently man enough to admit how vulnerable you are. Sometimes you have to be sufficiently confident of your intellect to admit that you don't understand something. So you may be able to understand derivatives. I frankly can't understand how a lot of them work. I can't understand how computers work. Now, I like to think my willingness, you know, just in terms of how you go from on, off, on, off, on, off, or 0-1, 0-1, 0-1, to little men running across the screen and blowing up and rescuing princesses from Persia and all sorts of other high-quality activities. Now, I like to think it's only because I'm fairly arrogant about my intellect that I'm happy to ask people, what the heck is going on with that? But if you feel that people think you're foolish, you don't admit your inabilities. And I think it's sometimes a man like David, who is so manly and who is so strong and is such a winner and has far too much testosterone, that sort of man, I think, can often say, I'm like a sheep. He can actually face the fact that he's fundamentally very vulnerable, like you are. You are so pathetically weak, aren't you? There are tiny little invisible creatures. If they get in your system, they can kill you. And they can get there almost, who knows how they get there. We are all so vulnerable. I don't just mean financially or at work, but I've had all sorts of highly competent friends who've gone to work confidently at their place of employment and have been escorted to the doors later on that day. Some things happen in the company, out they go. Life is actually very vulnerable. I mean, we put our trust in huge insurance companies. Was it HIH or something like that that in the 90s went under? Huge companies that, unless you're very, very close to them, you would never think in a year that they would be in trouble, and they are. If we stop and think about where we put all my money, well, I've never seen them, I've only ever seen numbers, that from, you know, is all with AMP. Well, I mean, they nearly went under in the 90s, didn't they? And so I expect to get to 65 and be retired and find that AMP said, look, we really, you enjoy that $50, and here's a few McDonald's and Lucky Meals sort of vouchers. You go and take your wife out somewhere special. But David understands that he's vulnerable. And he speaks here like a boasting sheep in the pub. You know, he's with the other sheep, they're just hanging around together. And he says, man, you should see my shepherd. Let me tell you about my shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. And when he uses that with the Lord, this is the God of Israel. This is the God who crushed the Pharaoh. This is the God who makes and keeps promises. This is the God who ultimately created the universe. This is the God who cares about little people, who enters into promises and covenants with them. And he says, the Lord Almighty is my shepherd. Therefore, logically, I shall not be in any need. That's the first thing he says. Insufficiency is never the problem. Now, you'll know, particularly if you've had the joy of being a parent, teaching children the difference between wants and needs, don't you? You know that, and every now and then I'll say, I need something, and friends will say, no, you don't. And that's very helpful. When he says here, I shall not want, he's not actually saying that it's a slightly old-fashioned use of the word want. It's not that you won't be in need or you won't want something. It's more that you won't be in need, sorry. That all that you need, you'll have. Since I've been a Christian for 30 years, here's how I've worked out what I need. Now, this may annoy some of you. But I've worked out what I need by what I get. I've got 1,000 undisciplined wants. And there's an industry that just in Australia alone employs some of the very best brains we have and uses billions of dollars to create a sense of need where you have no need at all. To totally artificially create our need. So we don't just need a roof over our heads and perhaps a working toilet, but we need X number of toilets and a certain sort of view and a certain sort of neighbour, and all this nonsense, and you don't. You can live quite well in much, 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 much smaller accommodation, in much less salubrious suburbs, with much poorer views, with much noisier neighbours. Billions of people do. But we've got all these things that we just picked up that we need. We don't. Now, if you have been blessed by God, and you have them, good luck to you. Enjoy them. Be thankful. Go for them. But there's not a need. You can work out what you need by what God gives you, if you're in that relationship. And so it's very helpful to realize that. That's how I work out what I need. There's lots of stuff I'd like. Lots of stuff God has given to friends of mine. Lots of stuff God has given to other members of my family. He's not given to me. I'd like them. Don't have them. Don't need them. And it's a question of working out, can I trust my shepherd? Because what a shepherd will do is, at times, a good shepherd knows that if you leave a sheep in its favourite type of grass or clovers and things like that, they'll kill themselves. They'll literally eat themselves to death. The shepherd at times has to use his stick to move the sheep along, out from the green pasture that they're enjoying, for a nice long walk to a different sort of grass. And so very often you won't get the thing that you want because the shepherd knows it'll kill you. So he says, I won't be in any want. Verse 4 is one of my favourites. He says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, the thing sheep hate is shadows. In fact, when we design abattoirs, in case you ever design abattoirs and you don't take this into account, both for cattle and for sheep, we have to be careful of shadows, because they just won't move down certain runs if the shadows are wrong. So when he talks about going through the valley of the shadow of death, this is like a sheep's nightmare scenario. And I'm sure some of you are in this valley or have recently passed through it. So George Malice, who comes here, is burying his mother today. That's a sort of horror that we all know we'll go through. But I was saying to Alison last night, I hate the day when I'm going to be in George's place. You know, and I know it'll come. It's part of the pageantry of life. But at times things... And he says, when I go through that valley, and the beautiful thing of the Bible is it doesn't just say it might happen, it kind of promises you it will happen. So in Isaiah 43, very similar passage, God's speaking about how much he loves his people, and he says this, when you pass through the river, it will not overflow you. When you walk through the fires, it will not destroy you, because I am with you. So I want the Bible to say, because I love you, shepherd, you won't have to go through the fire, you won't have to struggle through the river, you won't have to go through the valley of the shadow of death. It's exactly what the Bible never says, but it says when you go there, you won't be alone. And that's so David can simply summarize by saying, I fear no evil. One of my favorite quotes at the moment is from Justin Martyr, who was justly martyred at some stage down the road after he made this quote. But he said to the Romans at one stage, which must have been enormously irritating, you can kill us, but you cannot harm us. I just think that's an annoying thing to have said to you, because really the ultimate threat the state has is to kill you. But he just said to them quite calmly, you can kill us, but you cannot harm us. So David says, though I have to go through the experience that I dread, and he did. As an old man, he was back out in the fields, lost his family, civil war, people trying to kill him as an old man, not just as a young man, entering the valley of the shadow of death. He says, you are with me, and therefore I need fear no harm. The last thing he says before I finish is this, verse 6. This relationship with God does not come to an end in death. This is kind of how the Old Testament, the part of the Bible written before Jesus, seems to move towards the idea of what happens after death. It's on the understanding that there's a very deep and intimate and a wonderful relationship with the Creator that can be entered into now. And the growing sense that the people like David had is that this surely death won't have the last word on this relationship. So he says that I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now David, as you know, was a scumbag like all of us, in fact probably worse than most of us. He did some appalling things. Even after a man had been shown so much kindness by God, he betrayed one of his most loyal servants, stole his wife, murdered him, etc., etc. And yet he understands he's a forgiven man and understands that when he goes through death, sometimes the valley of the shadow of death doesn't end in death. One time we end that valley, it will end in death. You'll die, I'll die. And all of us are frightened by that. When people say they're not frightened by death, they're either lying or they're just not thinking. When people say, and the stupid studies that come out, people fear public speaking more than they do death, I say, really? Really? You've got cold feet before you speak and you say, I'm not going to do it. Your boss holds a gun to your head, shoots your secretary through the leg so you don't, and says, it's death or speak.
Yeah, death.
I mean, it's part of the childish denialism we have of death that we even pretend to fear public speaking more than death. Of course, death is the great terror. And what he's saying is, I understand that though I'm not going to enjoy the process, though I'm hardwired for life, it is the doorway to his place. And so he can say in the end, I'll not fear. Right? I don't need to fear death because I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So this psalm gives us the tools with which we can take on specific anxieties or the various sources of anxiety. How we do that is a longer episode. I should finish. A lot of it is doing what the Bible has done here. That is, it makes an assertion of truth. The Lord is my shepherd. And then it works it out logically. So the Bible will speak about things like calling to mind certain realities. So when I remember as a child, I used to go, my dad was a Mason, and we'd go on the annual Masonic harbour cruise from Lodge Galen. And I used to be terrified going over the harbour bridge. I was just kind of sure it was going to fall down. And I'd say to myself, now Ian, this bridge has been standing since the 1930s. And I'd have to reason with myself. Why would it fall down just the 2 minutes I'm under it? So, and I think what the Bible, and there were better reasons than that, but it's actually not just saying, I'm frightened, but thinking, well, what's really going on here? Those who are nervous about planes can assure themselves it's the safest means of transport that we have. All those sorts of things, you can work them out. I think what the Bible gives us is reasons to quell, things to bully our fears. But we can perhaps look at that in question time. Often anxiety is irrational. How does a rational God help? As some people say, if you stop and think about it, 95% of the things that we are anxious about don't happen, which some people suggest shows what a successful coping strategy it is, but I don't think that's the case. But I've been chatting with some friends of mine who are psychologists, and there's certainly some sorts of depression that I think need medication that we can show are actually to do with a lack of certain chemicals that can be helped. Anxiety, I'm not sure whether or not that needs drug help. I'm not aware of that. But I think for the ordinary fears that most of us live with, 95% of us, are they irrational? I think they are often irrational. But I think what we need to do is I think we need to bring them out of the murk and say, these are the seven things I'm anxious about. And then to deal with them. I think in the end, Christianity has found a strange ally in the recent most popular form of psychological tools in cognitive behavioral therapy, where they suggest that the problem normally is not the thing itself, but the way that we think about it. And that they will often get people to look at the thing they're frightened of. So phobias that seemed almost undealable with are eminently dealable with. In terms of looking at, and I think what I do when I'm anxious about things, when I think, why am I anxious? Often you feel the anxiety, and you can be almost in a paradisical sort of place, but not enjoying it because of your fears of the what if. Like you can be in an almost paradisical place and not enjoying it because you're full of hatred for someone who's done the dirty on you. It's easy to be in a beautiful place but not enjoy it, and unresolved relational hatred and anxiety, the two killers, I think. I think the way that God helps is by simply saying, let me have a look at this. Okay, I mean, I don't want to get too personal, but I mean, when I've looked at some of the anxieties I've got about my various situations, well, if God is as Jesus has revealed him to be, is he capable of dealing with this? So I remember I've had situations where I had organized a brilliant thing and then the building we were going to use got flooded, not burned. I've had some fun with buildings, but this one was flooded. And so suddenly this whole plan we'd had for about a year fell apart. And I was very worried, because not only was an important thing not going to happen, but more importantly, I was going to look like an idiot, which concerned me. and as well. And so I was concerned about both things, but then I remember saying to myself, God has not fallen off the throne. I don't know where that idea came from, but I kept saying, here's all these problems. Is the God who sent Jesus Christ, the God who gave his only son to die for me, this one who's obviously committed to me, is he capable of dealing with it? Does he love me? Has he forgotten me? Has he suddenly died? And to actually deal with my fears by bringing them next to or beside God. A little bit like if you had, say, a very rich benefactor who said, whatever bills you have until now and the time you die, I will meet. And bills came in that made you anxious. Gosh, I didn't know the gas bill was going to be that big. Now, that your initial response might be to be anxious. And what I think you need to do is remind, now, hang on, I've got a letter of promise here that all my bills will be met. Can I trust this person? And I think often it's actually a question of thinking through the irrational fear and taming it that way. Do women have more wants than men? We take a vote on that, I think. I was surprised to see going around the internet recently, again, that picture of, you know, the controls for a man off on, basically, you know, the sort of old amplifier thing, the controls for a woman, and there were just dials and knobs and needles. And I've got some women friends who think, yeah, that's right. I'm not sure if it is right. I don't know. But I do think part of the challenge, in 1 Peter 3, it says to Christian husbands, husbands should live with their wives according to knowledge. Now, we're not quite sure what that phrase means, but I've always understood it to mean, what I think it probably does mean, that it is the job of Christian husbands to understand their wives and to seek to understand them. And it talks about not despising them, because it's possible for men to look at the way that women respond to things and despise them for it, because they're not as entrepreneurial, they're not as solid, and so men can think, you're just an idiot. That we just think, no, you would never think that. But it's hard for men sometimes not to think, why are you not like I am? Wouldn't it be fun if they were? But I don't know if women have more needs. What is your best tip for assisting an overly anxious Christian child? So you're saying, is this question saying, if I'm here and here's someone close to me who's anxious? I think that's the question. Can I suggest to you that's I found that particularly hard. People who are anxious often resent being told that they can overcome their anxiety, and even if they're Christian and you say Jesus says do not be anxious, and how does he deal with that? Very just look at what Jesus in Matthew 6 talking to men who have left their employment, right? There is no Commonwealth employment system, there are no charitable organizations for Christian disciples back when Jesus is there. They've left their place of work, they've sometimes left families behind. He says, do not worry about what you will eat, what you will wear. And then he says, consider. So he actually asks them to think. And I would think that's the thing we need to do, is to help our friends think. So if it's a wife, since it's mostly men who are here, since it's a spouse or a child, I would think that you need to do two things. One is enter deeply into their anxiety to let them know that you're not trivializing it. Sometimes if you're not anxious and someone is, that's irritating, and they'll pick up your irritation to enter deeply into their anxiety. And then, often as not, if they're people who believe, just go straight to prayer and then talk. But then to gently remind them, to say, look, at times like this, I've found this helpful, rather than sort of smack them with a Bible sort of statement, to move in very gently and carefully.
Thanks very much, Ian.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.